do you pronounce it Hargraves or
June 28th, 1996. Robert Hargraves.
We're on the outskirts of Bakersfield?
Yeah.
Yeah, looks very nice outskirts. It's pleasant driving in here. And I always start off with a perfectly innocent question that everybody can answer. Your birth date.
May 27th, 1939.
And where were you born?
Ukiah, California.
Ukiah, California. And did you go to high school in Ukiah?
No. I went to high school in Stockton, California, Riverside, California, and Bakersfield, California.
Which always brings me naturally the next question. What did your parents do?
My father was a soils technician. He used to work for the Soil Conservation Service of the federal government, running around California and Nevada testing soils to make soils maps. Back in the 40s and 50s, they were mapping all the soil types of the United States. Then he ended up getting a job with the county egg commissioner here in Bakersfield, running their laboratory, testing soils and recommending fertilizers and that kind of stuff.
Great. Was your mother otherwise occupied?
Well, after us kids grew up, she went back to school and became a school teacher.
Okay. And how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Got one brother and three sisters. Sisters.
Did they ever do any volunteer work?
Oh, yeah. My brother went in the Peace Corps. And my sister, one sister did some missionary work in Pohnpei. It's in the...
Yes, Pohnpei well.
And she's living on Kwajalein right now with her husband. He's a pilot. And another sister, she went to Kodiak Island for a summer for some work with the Indians up there. And my oldest sister, I don't know if she hasn't done any Peace Corps type work, but she's been involved in the Boy Scouts a lot. We call that volunteer work.
You mentioned in the questionnaire you sent back to us that you had dreamed of becoming a Baptist missionary. I presume you were a Baptist when you were growing up.
Yeah, I still am.
You still are. Did you go to a Baptist college or did you?
No.
What school did you to college did you attend?
I went to Bakersfield Junior College, and then I went to University of California, Davis. I always majored in agriculture, and I don't know of any Baptist colleges that have agriculture.
No, that's an interesting point. When you were, how did you first hear about IPS?
I don't know. It was just in the college where it was. I applied for the Peace Corps. And IVS came along, so I checked them out too. So actually, I had a choice between going to India with the Peace Corps or Vietnam with IVS. And at the time, Vietnam sounded more interesting. But 6 months after I got there was when the Americans started sending soldiers in. So that kind of changed the outlook quite a bit.
Why did you think the Vietnam was more interesting than India? When was it just because it was in the news, or seemed more exotic? Or I know it's tough thinking back all those years.
Yeah, I think it's partly because the Peace Corps wanted me to work strictly with chickens. That was what I'd be doing for 2 years, and with IVS it was a more general agricultural theme, so I'd be doing more different things. They ended up doing a lot of stuff with chickens in Vietnam.
But you did other things, because you did the grape project. Do you remember first hearing of IVS when you were in college as opposed to any earlier experience?
No, when I was in college. No, actually, I never heard of it until I was getting my master's, finishing up my master's degree and was looking for Peace Corps or something like that, the experience.
Well, let's put it this way. When you're finishing your master's degree in agriculture, and you decided that you obviously wanted to do some overseas service.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do that? As opposed to just go on and get a job or go on for a doctor?
Well, because I wanted to be a missionary, and the mission board says, well, you got to have some overseas experience before we'll even look at you.
So that made you think of that. By the way, that's the perfect answer to that question. I mean, there's no right answer to any of these questions, but that one does explain exactly why you did that, which is great. And when you, I'm trying to see if I've left anything. When you, did you have any, no, I don't, threat isn't the right word, but in those days, the presumption was that you were going to be drafted.
Yeah.
Right? But of course, you had already gone through school. How old were you when you got your master's degree?
Oh, I think about 23 or 24.
Yeah. Had the draft ever been?
Well, I was one of those 6 months. I was in the service for 6 months and then in the reserves for 7.5 years.
Uh-huh.
So that, strangely enough, I got my discharge papers in Vietnam.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Because someone got drafted in Vietnam, by the way. We didn't realize that someone had actually got their discharge papers in Vietnam. So that kind of rounds out the picture there. It was funny. I think it was Fred Branfman, I think, was in Laos. And his draft board said, you've got to come back here because we're going to... He says, well...
Yeah, I met him in Saigon. He was... Oh, my God. You know, he was in Saigon to report for the draft.
That is funny. And let's see. So you'd done a military service, which they let you out after 6 months. They just didn't need.
Yeah, well, you have to go to meetings once a week.
After that.
Yeah. 2-hour meetings, and then for 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last 4 years, you didn't have to do anything, but you were on call if there ever was a war. Which fortunately there was.
There wasn't, yes. And let's see. Did you do, when you did your active service, where were you when stationed?
Fort Ord.
Yeah. The meningitis capital of California. I'm getting back to
the pneumonia capital.
Yeah, pneumonia, yes. And when you were recruited to IVS, you know, they didn't, in the early years, they didn't have a lot of specialized training, but did you go to Harper's Ferry?
Yeah.
For the introduction?
Right.
And but you didn't go
spent 3 or 4 days there.
3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
So you were, when you were recruited to IVS, that was a time where they were largely hiring people with actually degrees in the fields that they were assigning. It wasn't like they were taking young people out for an adventure or experience. Right. No. They were all, so in your group at that introductory meeting, there would only be people with specialized expertise.
Yeah, well, there was 8 of us went to Vietnam together, and most of them were teachers, English teachers, and I think there were just me and one other that were doing agricultural work.
Do you remember who any of those people were? I mean, does a name pop into your head? A last name?
No, I'm just not offhand.
Hey, it might come back, by the way, as we keep going. If you think of it, just let me know. And when you got to Vietnam, was there any... Did you get any training or any backgrounding when you first arrived?
They said it was during the summertime, and so we got a couple of Vietnamese English teachers that weren't teaching at the time to teach us Vietnamese for a couple of months.
And was the summer of 1963, was it?
65.
Yeah. So you were there from 65 to 67?
Right.
Huh. And that's where the 6 months earlier. So you got there in the summer of 65. Actually, summer of 65 was when they made the decision to commit large numbers of U.S. combat troops. There were about 60,000 U.S.
combat
troops.
But I didn't know it.
No, you didn't. So when you arrived in Vietnam, actually, this was the, let's see, if you got there in the summer of 65, there was no buildup.
Right.
What was your feeling about Vietnam then? I mean, just to read generally.
Well,
I'm just curious. You know, was it a country that looked like, there obviously was some kind of civil unrest somewhere, but it wasn't very visible? Or was it something that you saw quickly that it was a country in turmoil? For example, the Brinks Hotel was blown up. That, not when you were there, I don't think. It was earlier.
Yeah.
But events like that were happening. And
oh, yeah. They had barbed wire all over the place. Uh-huh. And the watchtowers were all over the Delta. That's where our 2 months language training was, down in the Delta.
Uh-huh.
And
that was at an IVS compound?
Yeah.
They had a, right.
Well, actually, the teaching itself took place at a local high school.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed at an IVS compound there.
Mm-hmm. And so by the fall of 1965, you were ready to ply your trade.
So I went off to Phan Rang.
Uh-huh.
And they hired an interpreter for me and just left me there in Phan Rang. Gene Stolzfus came along and helped find a place uh-huh. for us to stay. He was my immediate supervisor.
Okay. But otherwise you were on your own.
On my own, yeah.
And one fellow was saying how he latched onto a Chinese agricultural advisor who needed an interpreter. And for his whole 2 years, he basically went around being the interpreter for the Taiwanese agricultural specialist. But you had a lot more hands-on work than that. What kind of programs were you in? Well, how did you get started setting up your program once you?
Well, actually, I was lucky. The local AID administrator, Larry Lawrence, had been with IVS, and he was very helpful in introducing me to the people I needed to know in that province.
Mm-hmm.
And I got hooked up with the agricultural the Vietnamese in the agricultural service and in the animal husbandry service, and asked, well, what kind of things can I do for you? And they said, well, you know, we need some help out at the research center. They had a couple of research centers, and we want some information about cotton, which the U.S. wouldn't give them because cotton it was forbidden for AID to provide any assistance that was receiving government funds for any crop, you know, like corn and cotton, and rice.
It makes sense when you think about it. I did speak with, I have one of my students, his father raises rice in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, my family's kind of worried about Vietnam coming back into the world's,
yeah.
you know, rice market. And, so you settled on, what were the first projects that you settled into doing? With all those different variables.
Well, the first thing they sent me to do was going around, 2 years before, they had a big flood in that area, and with a lot of flood aid, and the U.S. government set up a program passing out cement and sheet iron for roofing and all that kind of stuff, and two pigs apiece to 400 families in the area. Mm-hmm. And they wanted me to go around 2 years later and find out what happened. And I'd say about 80% of the pigsties had people living in them.
They were well built?
Yeah, better than most of the huts. And when I asked what happened to the pigs, they'd say, oh, we ate them.
Everyone was delighted to receive your report. And what happened after you handed in that report?
I never heard.
Never heard. And the next stop on your activities?
Well, then they were saying that they had a lot of requests to get American chickens from the research station in Saigon, but they didn't have any way of getting them. So I set up a program of, you know, most of these guys just wanted 10 or 20 or 100 at a time. So I'd go around and see these guys, see what kind of setup they have, and try and make some kind of rational sense out of it. Because, you know, a lot of these guys wanted the chickens because they thought it was a good idea and didn't know the first thing about what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go down to Saigon maybe once a month just to check in on things. And bring back a couple hundred baby chicks with me and sell them for the cost of what they were, 10 cents a piece, I mean. And, you know, I'd take orders ahead of time. And then I'd go around visiting these people and seeing how they were doing with them and making sure they kept their vaccinations up and all that kind of stuff. Oh, we had this one guy. He ordered 100 chicks, and I came out to see how he was doing. He was all excited and made me take him down to the next village about 5 clicks away. And this other guy had, 20 chickens, and all their feathers had fallen out. And they were sunburned and ugly looking. This guy was so excited. Because he said, this is great, because you don't have to pluck them. So he bought two of them and took them back with him. And I said, you know, I didn't think this was such a good idea, because we had no idea what made those feathers fall. And a week later, I came back to see how the chickens I'd sold him was. And he said, well, he says, those American chickens are weak. They all died. But the other ones, the featherless ones, they're doing great.
The featherless ones.
Yeah.
But they were the same chicks, though. I mean.
No.
No.
Those were Vietnamese type, the ones that had the feathers falling out. So whatever, I figured that they introduced something to and killed all the ones that I'd sold them. Uh-huh. And whatever it was, these other ones that survived it. Yeah, there's always a few survive almost anything.
Anything. So they're all the same chicken.
Type, yeah.
Yes, but he thought that there must be different types.
Yeah.
Yes. And he assumed that the American ones just didn't have it.
Yeah.
Yes, but they were all Vietnamese chickens. They were all bred in Saigon, or...
No, they were American.
They were all American types.
Bred at the Saigon
right.
Experiment station. Mm-hmm. In fact, we got into problems that we later found out that the chickens from the experiment station in Saigon had Pilorum disease, and we were introducing it to the country.
How do you spell that?
Pilorum, yeah. P-U-L-L-O-R-U-M.
And you were introducing it to the country?
Yeah.
And what impact did that have down the road?
Well, I think we caught it early enough, and they went through the experiment station in Saigon and and tested them all and cleaned it up, you know, to make sure I got some antigen, and went around testing everything in the province I could get my hands on, and everything else was clean. It was just the stuff from Saigon, the Saigon experiment station that had it. So it wasn't something that was just going around.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Always looking for lessons learned, these kind of projects, and that's a good one right there. Of course, Jim Roop has already filled me in on all the different techniques for inoculating chickens that you developed. But I know you did. You probably always did some sort of chicken service while you were there. But you worked on the animals while you were there. Did you work on another animal crop other than or livestock other than chickens?
Yeah, well, they got me involved in. They had a big vaccination program for rinderpest, and they got me roped into that because I had one of the few vehicles, and they needed somebody to drive the rest of them around from village to village to do the vaccination.
What kind of animal in Vietnam does that affect?
Cows and water buffaloes.
Oh. And did you always travel with an interpreter, or did that need become less as things went?
My interpreter quit after 1 month because I was reluctant to hold hands with him.
But that's just a customary Vietnamese gesture.
I know it, but it's not a customary American gesture.
Did you feel? Yeah, go ahead.
I felt uncomfortable about it.
Did you just tell him you just felt uncomfortable?
Yeah.
So he quit. Do you think he quit out of kind of nationalistic pride, or he just really loved you and wanted to hold your hand?
He quit because he thought I insulted him.
No. He must have been very sensitive. I don't think anyone would. Not usual to get that upset, but he may have been a very sensitive person. Were you ever assigned another translator?
No.
You felt you got along fine without it after that, by that
point? Well, I got along. You know, there's a lot of things you can communicate without saying a lot of fancy words.
Did, other than livestock, you worked with agricultural crops?
Yeah.
Grapes seems to have been a pretty big success there. How did that program start?
On the road into Phan Rong from Nha Trang, there was a house with a grapevine growing along the side, and it was the only grapevine I'd ever seen in Vietnam. So I got to thinking that maybe, you know, Phan Rong is a lot drier climate than most of Vietnam. So I thought, well, maybe this climate here fits grapes better than the other ones. But that particular grapevine never had any grapes on it. So, it really wasn't doing any good. It was just ornamental. When I asked later about it, why, they said, well, the birds get them all. So, but then I later found another guy that had a bunch of grapevines, and it had blossoms on it and never developed fruit. So I wrote home, and my father got me about 30 different varieties, just sent them to me through the mail from the University of California Experiment Station. And I gave them to the experiment station in Phan Rong, or the actually just outside of Phan Rong, and they planted them all, and they all had the names of the varieties around the stems. And 2 days after I gave it to them, they came back and they said, what are the names of these? And they said, well, they're on the stems. Oh, we threw those away. So they never did. Well, I mean, this that apparently only one variety really caught on real well. But they never did have the name of it or where it came from.
So how did they propagate?
Well, like any grape, you graft it onto a root base.
Beginning with the one plant that they had.
Yeah.
So they I'm just interested on the genetic property of the. Of the Vietnamese grape industry. It's all sold together. Well, it doesn't matter. It's a varietal, right? So
yeah.
It just doesn't matter that much. But so,
grapes are easy. I mean, you look at this plant out here. I'm trimming it back every week. And every time you cut off a piece, if you stick it in the ground, it'll grow. Mm-hmm. You can get hundreds of pieces from one grapevine.
Yes. But, of course, you're kind of lucky because this is a huge grape. I noticed a lot of grape vineyard on the other side, on the eastern side, the 99. They're a lot of grape.
Yeah.
And my father noticed it too. He said, "Hey, those are nice grapes."
Oh, yeah.
And
it's the number one crop in Kern County, next to cotton.
And but of course, the government had no objection to the planting of grapes in the area because there's no price supports for grapes in the U.S.
Yeah, but. I really, you know, I gave them some help with cotton and rice and that other stuff too, but without telling the U.S. government about
it. Speaking of which, what was your relationship with the USAID, you know, USAID in Finland?
Well, like I told you, Larry Lawrence was running the show there.
Right,
he got along very well.
Got on very well. There was always, not backtracking, but continuing, one of the issues that's the whole IBS experience is connected with is how closely can a voluntary organization be associated with a government, you know, with a third, with a foreign government, and what impact that might have on the service. And there that actually operates at two levels, bureaucratic, but of course with Larry there, that's not much of a problem. But there's bureaucratic on the one hand, and then the other is political.
Yeah.
And if you were, for example, a CO opposed to U.S. policy in Vietnam and you were an IVS, you generally felt that USAID was a monster and you had as little to do with it as possible. And if you were there earlier, where that issue, the war was less of an issue, USAID was more of a, well, they're the ones who give me all my stuff, so naturally.
Yeah.
You know, they're a component of the work that I do. But if you had to describe the way USAID worked with you and the way you viewed them when you were in Vietnam, that'd be great. Any kind of overall view.
Well, I'd say we worked very well together. I think it changed later. Of course, IBS pulled out pretty much not too long after I left. Anyway, partly because of that there was a big shift in AID in Vietnam that the U.S. Congress cut the funds for AID in half in 66. I think it was like that. But the AID, the General Economic Development in Vietnam was doubled. And at the same time, the U.S. government announced that in order to accomplish this, the U.S. military was taking over the functions of the program. So they were basically taking over AID, and they had separate so-called military people come in. And they were called CID, Criminal Investigation Division of the Army. And that was their function, was to oversee the development program of AID and everybody else. And they built their own compound and were super secret. And everybody called them CIA.
They were CIA, though, weren't they?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
But
did they have a province kind of headquarters compound? Well, was this, is this related to chords?
No.
No. Okay. And but this is just to straight. In other words, MACV sent a team, which were identified as CID in your area, and they were responsible for giving direction to all USAID and USAID supported activities in the province. That's
and
pretty interesting.
Those AID activities were immediately oriented towards anything that would stop the Viet Cong rather than general assistance for people.
Can you give me an example of the kind of projects they favored or channeled?
They would pick out villages that were Viet Cong controlled, and tell all the Vietnamese agencies, animal husbandry and public health and all that, to go to these particular villages and give them help, and forget about all these other villages that the Viet Cong aren't concentrating on.
Did you think that was a successful distribution of labor?
No, in fact, the Vietnamese people were complaining about that. They were getting less assistance, unless they happened to be in a Viet Cong-controlled area.
On the second side with Dr. Robert Hargreaves, talking about Organization for Pacification and Support, I suppose. Yeah. Did you think that reorienting may not have been successful because the rest of the Vietnamese didn't like it? Was it successful in terms of making any impact on the villages that you were serving?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Because the Viet Cong were working very hard to organize these particular villages, and you can't go in overnight and unorganize something that's organized. I mean, you might be able to after several years, but you wouldn't expect an overnight effect on something like that. Changing people isn't something that happens overnight.
No. Do you think given the climate that the war was at when you were there, was your impression then that this was really kind of misguided? That, in other words, what you just said, was that a feeling you had at the time, that we need a lot more time to work successfully under these conditions? Or?
Yeah, well, not just time. It wasn't just misguided. It was... they set up this... redevelopment corps or something like that, where they got a bunch of draftees to go into the villages, and you know, they'd give them 8 weeks training in agriculture and public health and all this, and they were supposed to go into these villages. You know, they give them a rifle, they were, and most of them joined up to get out of being in the regular army, and there were a bunch of young kids that had an 8-week course in something and really didn't know what they were doing. And the villagers, for the most part, didn't like them.
Were you supposed to assist the revolutionary development, those revolutionary development units, in doing their jobs?
Well, they had me go along a couple of times just to observe. The first thing they did going into a village was simply to take a, what they called that, census grievance. Line up everybody and take a census and have everybody air their grievances against everybody else. That, you know,
that was
to me
amazing,
that seemed like really asking for trouble.
Exactly, and it really was. I mean, that was like the ultimate in wrong-headed administration. I always remembered that. It's stuck in my mind over the years. The did the fact that a couple of times you would go along with them, or that USAID was kind of pushing these kinds of projects, do you think that kind of exposed you to additional danger than you might have been under? You know, by identifying you a little more closely with a government programs?
Well, I don't know particularly. Mm-hmm. That there was a certain element of danger in doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was kind of immune to worrying about the danger by that time. You know, well, I had just come from a year in Mississippi, and I felt a lot more under strain and danger there than I ever did in Vietnam.
Well, that puts you in a small but important group. Fred Bramfman, who served in Laos, also had worked in Mississippi beforehand. And that kind of slipped out in your biography there. That didn't appear. So when did you work in Mississippi, between undergrad and graduate school?
No, right at the end of graduate school there. In 64, they had this big Mississippi Freedom Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a Freedom School teacher for the summer. And then I went back for the first part of 65, just before I went to Vietnam. Then they had a bunch of kids were expelled from school for wearing these SNCC pins that had black and white hands held together in friendship. We had about 300 of them. So they asked me to put together a private school for these kids for the rest of the school year. It was about 3 months. That was a very interesting experience.
I bet you it was. Do you think you carried that? You probably answered this question in some way, but that experience went with you to Vietnam, in a sense.
Yeah.
You felt tested, that you felt you've gone through hell already, so to speak.
Yeah, you might say that.
Uh-huh. And now I'm going to give your name to the people who do the oral history of the Freedom Summer Project. Have you ever spoken to anyone?
No, I've gotten a few letters once in a while.
Yeah, that's a very special group of people. You should answer them. I don't know if they'll send a guy like me out to talk to you, but I think that's a very special part of recent American history that we shouldn't lose contact with. Did you ever... I'm not an American historian. I'll leave that go. Did people in the villages and districts you worked in, did they clue you in on VC activity in the sense of saying, maybe you shouldn't go to that village this week? What were your relations with the district officials? I mean, did they... There's so many different levels of government in a Vietnamese province.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd love to, you know, if we had an infinite time and your memory was infinitely... I'd love to go through each phase, like what were your relations with the district officer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but I'm much more interested in your impressions. What did you think of the Republic's administrative structure and the officials in the district that you worked in?
Well, mostly officials were... I don't know. I got along with them pretty well, but it's easy to get along with the Vietnamese if you say the right things and do the right things. They will never say to your face you're doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's easy to get along with them. It was a kind of a top-down situation where... it was an ambitious thing. The guy that had the money was paying for his office. And these were all an ambitious bunch of people that were in office. And it was costing them money to stay there. And they were getting it any place they could. By American standards, it was bribery, theft, fraud, anything you can call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were. It was the mafia run rampant.
Where do you think that started, or what fueled that? I mean, obviously Vietnam had not, had it always been run that way? Is that your impression? Or was it something relatively recent, 5-10 years or something like that, because of the war, the changes in
Vietnam? Well, I think that traditionally, you know, they followed the Chinese civil service type of thing, and that in China, in times of, in bad times, when the generals were running things instead of the people that passed the civil service test, they did the same kinds of things. And I think they were pretty much following tradition in doing this, except that there was 1,000 times more money to fuel it.
Where did all the money come from?
America.
That was only, if we were in court, a defense attorney would say, that was a leading question. Asked and answered. Yes. What were some of the things that those officials were trying to do to, of course, recoup their investment in their office that, that you might have observed?
When I was there in Nha Trang, which is just 60 clicks north of Phan Rang, which is the main harbor, they had so many boats unloading cement and equipment and automobiles and everything there that they were backed up for a month waiting to unload. And they were giving this stuff away to the Vietnamese. And it was the officials that controlled all this, and they were selling most of it and pocketing the money, or using it to build themselves fancy houses, that kind of stuff. And the American government was apparently paying so much ahead for any soldier you could recruit. And I understand they had a lot of soldiers on paper that they didn't have.
Sure. And what were your, do you remember any kind of the more closer relations between yourself and Vietnamese that you developed while you were there?
Well, there was this one guy that was a photographer. That he was raising a couple of hundred chickens, and I got the chickens for him and was helping him raise them and vaccinate and all that kind of stuff. He took me fishing a couple of times and invited me over to dinner, and we went out to the movies. That was fun. And there was a Vietnamese doctor at the local hospital that I was helping raise chickens, and he was more into canaries, really, than he was into chickens.
And were you ever able to maintain any contact with the people in that district after you left Vietnam?
No. No.
So you're not in touch with any of them today?
No.
Is he in practice now here?
No, he works with the same kind of job I'm doing.
Which is what exactly?
I'm a state veterinarian. Uh-huh. I investigate disease outbreaks. Anything that's too big for the local practitioners to handle, or that the state requires state intervention in. So like this chicken flu thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, let's look at just a few more questions, really. Were you in Vietnam when Don Luce wrote that letter that he circulated around, asked people to sign,
no,
sending it to Washington? That happened after? Oh, it must have, because Jim Root signed that letter. And he came while you were leaving.
I left in July, mm-hmm, of 67, and just the day before I left, they had a big meeting in Saigon. About half the volunteers were all there together voicing all their objections, saying, we can't work under these conditions, the government is corrupt, and all that kind of stuff. And it kind of made me curious what a stay to see what was going to happen.
Uh-huh.
But then I understand about 6 months after, then they quit. Right after I left, about half of them just quit. It broke their contract and left. And I understand that about 6 months later, IBS withdrew from the country entirely.
Not entirely.
Yeah.
But there was a reorganization. A lot of people were allowed to go because of the Tet Offensive.
Yeah.
The whole Prague program was problematical. But it continued, but eventually was terminated by USAID.
Yeah.
But I think well, still doing research, but I think it continued in other forums doing some work, I think, for the MNM. What did you think about that? You know, about people complaining about the conditions in which they're working it, with a government being corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. How did you feel about that?
Well, I thought most of their points were pretty valid, that we would have been a lot better off if people had listened. And, you know, people should have done more complaining about that. Even if, you know, some of them were a little hot-headed about it, if you could have people sit down and talk about it, you might have gone some different direction.
Do you think that was possible, though? In other words, given the nature of things, would it have been possible to improve the delivery of humanitarian aid in Vietnam? Of course, that's a stupid question. Anything's possible.
Yeah, anything.
But the idea is, given the structure of the way things were set up, and with the militarization of USAID.
Well, probably not very likely. And then I got to thinking about afterwards. You know, some of the people I knew ended up getting killed. That I was thinking at that point, there are plenty of other places in the world where you can really be doing some good for a lot less effort.
What were your feelings when you left Vietnam? Did you always expect that at the end of your contract you would go on to something else? You know, did you feel like
I thought I'd go on to something else, but then what? I don't know. I never expected to end up back in California.
But you didn't think of extending your tour in Vietnam, you know, signing up for another 2 years or anything?
No,
like that?
The way things were going in Vietnam, it just didn't look like it would accomplish anything.
Did you think that that America's investment and all that effort was eventually going to come to nothing by the time you left? I mean, rather than retrospect, but at the time you left, did you in '67? Did you feel that things were going downhill instead of uphill?
I can't say I had enough vision then to say what direction it was going. All I could say was I had a bad feeling about it. It wasn't going in the right direction. But uphill, downhill, who knows?
No, that was interesting. Sounds like there was a chapter heading in there somewhere, what you just said. And what were your feelings as you left Vietnam? You know, there's a lot of, you look out that window and you see the country receding, something like that. Do you remember what you were thinking of then as you headed back to the States of that 2 years you had spent in Vietnam? Or you just focused on the next thing you were going to do, whatever it was?
No, I really enjoyed spending 2 years in Vietnam. The Vietnamese are really very friendly people. Yeah. And I think that in some ways that IVS is still part of Vietnam now. And the library's there. They don't have any books more recent than 30 years ago. And they have a lot of books stamped IVS.
Where? In
In Saigon, in University of Saigon.
Saigon,
And a lot of people are, it's amazing, people around that remember the American days. And of course, see, there's a lot of old soldiers that don't like the Americans, too. But That's understandable.
Have you been? You have been back to Vietnam since then.
Yeah.
When was the first time you went back?
91.
And who sponsored your visit?
Well, it was with Don Luce. It was just a tourist thing. Mm-hmm. Curious about what it was like after all those years.
And let's see, was Galen Beery in that group?
No.
Chuck Cable.
He went the week before.
Oh, okay.
I did. There were two different tours.
Uh-huh.
And too bad I wasn't with him. He was looking for our old cook. And he really
getcha.
But he didn't, apparently he didn't know that she had been part of the Viet Minh had massacred her entire village.
Mm-hmm.
She was a sole survivor back in 1945. Mm-hmm. And she was virulently anti-communist back when we were there in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to go around asking for somebody like that 30 years later is kind of asking for trouble.
I don't think Chuck grasped that point as thoroughly as he might have. I think he was very frustrated at the obstructionism of the local authorities, because they charge them with all sorts of crimes without explaining why. You've just explained why, and I think that that's probably exactly true. He said the other problem was that since her whole village had been wiped out, it was very hard to track her down through more conventional means. You know, like going to her home village. Well, yes, but who can talk to you and things like that? So he was very frustrated by that. Any other thing happened in 91 that you thought was... I mean, did something happen to you during that trip that you thought
was
interesting?
No, nothing happened. Yeah. Well, of course, that was in Phan Rang.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went through a week later, Don wouldn't even think of
stopping. So you never got to go back?
No.
No, you just kept driving.
Yeah.
That was amazing. But did you get to visit some old haunts in Saigon? Did you ever try to find the old extension office and see what they were doing?
No, we didn't have much on that. But as I understand, we went back just a year after they legalized private enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back, they had all these little fuzz shops and haircut shops, and everybody's running around real... At every corner had somebody with a little stand with the air pump and oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
And how can they support so many businessmen like this? You know, then somebody told me that they'd only allowed this for a year. Before that, all these shops were shuttered up for 20 years. Yeah. But to me, it was kind of like a time warp, going back to the 60s, and then later talking with the Vietnamese that it had really gone downhill to almost nothing, and we caught them back on the upswing, right about the same level as it was in the 60s.
With a little less crime, at least at the moment. Yeah. That's a great observation.
In Phan Rang, there really wasn't that much crime.
No,
there.
Saigon is working its way back up, and even in Hanoi, there's the issue isn't whether there's prostitution or not. It's just how widespread is it, how built into the economy is it, and that hasn't happened quite yet. But time will tell. As someone who wanted to be a Baptist minister, you didn't become one, I noticed. But someone who, and you know, it's a for a Baptist missionary for a Clinton Gore sticker in your house. I don't know if those two, I'm making a joke there. I was thinking of Disneyland more than the presidential election, the recent controversy. But as someone who had those kind of values when you were in Vietnam, did you ever feel you were, you know, kind of doing something good to oppose the spread of communism. Was that ever an issue that worked its way into your activities?
I don't know, not consciously, but, you know, I don't like to work negatively opposing so much as working positively to be for something. Mm-hmm.
But in your work, there's a theory put forward by actually leftists, I would imagine, that particularly in Laos, because there was a war, that USAID was actually running at the behest and leadership of the CIA, and that put IPS in the position of being more visibly connected with what would be called formal counterinsurgency operations. I think that's an exaggeration, by the way. That's not what happened in Laos, I don't believe. Something close to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but closer in any way in Vietnam. In Vietnam, as the war went on, more and more of the staff of IPS were actually conscientious objectors. They were doing service in Vietnam because they wanted to do something good.
Well, Chuck Cable was a conscientious objector.
And they felt the politics weren't the interest. It was more of, let's do something good in here since so much bad is happening also.
Yeah.
But you were there in the early years when, or at least at the beginning, where all those political dimensions were a little less clear, and in which a person could just look at it, you know, in a unique way, which is, hey, this is an interesting place in the world. Things are happening there. I want to see an interesting place in the world. And holy cow, I'm in some deep doo-doo here. You know, but I think I'm trying to explore the problems. A lot of people seem to be not so much caught by surprise, but not really having a very clear idea of how complex the situation would be in Vietnam. And
I think it's their own fault, mostly. I think what Don Luce's book, you know, Vietnam, the Unheard Voices, I think probably, you know, there's some ways you can say a little better, but I'd say the number one fault of the United States was they didn't listen to the Vietnamese. Now, it doesn't mean they had to do everything the Vietnamese said, but to just shut them out entirely and say, well, this is the way we're going no matter what.
How did you, you know, personally, did you ever experience that process? And did you ever observe an occasion in which the Vietnamese just simply seemed shut out, and their own needs and their own desires being kind of railroaded?
Well, when we were there, the United States decided they needed an election to justify their being there, saying it was, you know, we're there to protect democracy and all that baloney. So they said, they told the Vietnamese, you will have an election. And went around organizing all behind the scenes. You know, they were very careful to say, you know, under no circumstances let anybody see you doing this. And they elected a lot of people. And it was basically just to justify the U.S. being there. And they didn't really care what they did. And it didn't really matter what they did after they got elected.
Did you think the 67 elections were fair, or was there a...
Not particularly. That the Vietnamese had their ways of rigging things.
And
the ones that the Americans wanted to get elected got elected.
There were ones that the Americans wanted to get elected? You mean in the higher leadership positions?
Yeah.
Yes, I can't remember, but I think it was...
Well, really, the elections, there were only for two things. One for the presidency, and the other for the Constitutional Assembly.
That's correct.
You know, and it's a joke when all you vote for is the president, and then the president appoints everybody under him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not really a democracy when all you vote for is the president.
Although LBJ was very proud that he actually had an election in Vietnam. I mean, that was considered an accomplishment. And other people admired him for that at least some efforts were made But you, just for the fun of it, you just mentioned, you know, to bring democracy to Vietnam and that baloney. What did you mean by that?
Well, the standing joke going around Vietnam when I was there was that if they had free elections in North Vietnam at that time, they would have voted to kick the communists out. Mm-hmm. If they had free elections in South Vietnam at that time, they would have voted the communists in. Mm-hmm.
And I think they were right. Just one of the great ironies of it all. In fact, there's a theory that that's why the Tet Offensive happened, in a sense, because the price of continuing the war was so great that the North Vietnamese had to do something dramatic to show the people that they were trying to press home to victory as soon as possible. Whereas Weiserhead said, this is not a war you can win quickly. That's not the Vietnamese way anyway. And in the South, they were afraid that there wouldn't be any communists left because of the pace of the violence in the South. So they both opted for an operation which killed a lot of people, their own people as well as ours.
Yeah.
But did lead to the end of the war in the sense that negotiations followed. And as one IVSer said, and I thought for sure that would be the end of it, but ground on for another 7 years. This is the great tragedy. It just didn't seem to end. But I'm glad you mentioned Don Luce's book. Are there any other books that you've ever seen or heard about Vietnam that just touched your consciousness that you thought of?
There are whole shelves and shelves of books in the library. Mm-hmm. I would say the one thing that strikes me about most of them is that no two of them seem to agree with each other. Mm-hmm. You read two back to back and you wonder if they're writing about the same planet. That they have such a different outlook. You know, I'd say most of them are either pro-communist or anti-communist, and everything they write is bent around that one thing.
That's about it, a couple of questions. Well, I always like to ask this at the end. After you left Vietnam, what did you end up doing for the next 30 years? I mean, we know what you're doing now. But what did you do after that?
Well, the first thing I did when I got back was the biggest mistake of my life. I got married.
Mm. And then?
And then my wife went back to school to get her teaching credential. And I went back to veterinary school. And then I figured, well, okay, then we'll go back overseas. But my wife wouldn't have nothing to do with that.